Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Transportation Committee to order. Today is Thursday, March 30th, 2023. We're in the Barnes Committee Room, Room 124 of the Alaska State Capitol Building. Let the record reflect that the time is 1 p.m. Today we have President Representative Craig Johnson, Representative McKay, Representative Vance, Representative Sumner, and myself, Chair McCabe. The staff assisting us today are Jordan Wright, Moderator Zach Lawhorn, and my committee aide, Buddy Wick, who will also be presenting today. Thank you for your service today, gentlemen. We have one item on today's agenda. House Bill 128, sponsored by this committee, will have its first hearing today. My plan is to hear an introduction and an overview from my committee aide, Buddy Wick, take committee questions, public testimony, and then set the bill aside for additional work and bring it back at a later date. While Mr. Witt makes his way to the presenter's table, I would like to let committee members know that we have the following individuals appearing via Teams to assist with committee member questions. Tiffany Larson is the Director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response. Cameron Jimmo, Department of Law. Jim Butler, Baldwin and Butler. Kevin O'Shea from Vitus Marine will be available if we have any questions. So, Mr. Witt, please place your name on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Buddy Witt, staff to Chair McCabe and to the House Transportation Committee. The chair was approached about this particular issue, and in looking at the change in the bill as well as the regulatory conversation that made it that evolved into the bill. I thought that kind of a background on what regs that the that are involved in this, how the conversation came to be, and the reason for the bill, or as a suggested fix to the kind of the issue, would be a good idea for the committee. And as Mr. Chairman, as you said, there are subject matter experts online who are more versed in this than I am, and most of the questions I will divert to them. So House Bill 128, the discussion began.
So thank you. Let the record reflect that Representative Mina has joined us at 102. Welcome.
The discussion began with the Department of Environmental Conservation was looking at regulations and making some changes to regulations. And so this is the one that kind of popped out and caught folks' attention and where the discussion actually began, and is with Alaska 18 Alaska Administrative Code 75.432, in particular subsection B, that states the response planning standard volume for a crude or non-crude oil terminal facility is equal to the capacity of the largest oil storage tank at the facility covered by the plan, unless there are specific natural or man-made conditions outside the facility which could place the facility at an increased risk of an oil discharge affecting or affecting one or more storage tanks. So that's what the regulation initially said. During the discussion of the regulation and DEC's process, the bolded and underlined language was proposed to be added, and so then after more storage tanks, this additional sentence would be added: for vessels operating as oil terminal facilities, the response planning standard is based on the entire storage capacity of the vessel. So then that brings up questions: well, how can a vessel be an oil terminal facility, which is more generally believed to be a land-based operation, not a water-based operation? So the Alaska Fuel Storage and Handling Association made a response, and they were, when those regulations were originally proposed, and their response or request for action and proposed change was to delete the language that is being added. Then they had subsequent questions regarding what is a vessel operating, when is a, what exactly is a vessel operating as an oil terminal facility. Please define and provide parameters when a vessel is considered an oil terminal facility, asking questions about under the new requirements, would the RPS of 120,000 barrels non-crude barge be 120,000 barrels? Why isn't the 15% reduction utilized since these are vessels and et cetera? And the response that DEC came back with was that the definition in 18 Alaska Administrative Code 1875.990 and the statute, which we are going to look at, 46.04900 subsection 14, for oil terminal facility, answers all of their questions. The definition of oil terminal facility includes, quote, a vessel other than a non-tank vessel is considered an oil terminal facility only when it is used to make a ship-to-ship transfer of oil and when it is traveling between the place of the ship-to-ship transfer of oil and an oil terminal facility, which is, well, I had to read that three or four times not to be a little bit confused by it. But again, this isn't my area of expertise. A vessel that falls under the definition of AS 4604-900 subsection 14 is subject to the requirements for an oil terminal facility, including the requirement at Alaska Administrative Code 75.430 subsection C1, the proposed edit, etc. So then we start looking at definitions. This is the current statutory definition of an oil terminal facility, and I'm sure you've read the bill, so you can see that definition already. That was, put in because it was referred in the DEC's response. The regulatory definition that is also included in their response is found to say oil terminal facility as the meaning given in 4604-900 and includes vessels classified as oil terminal facilities under Alaska Administrative 18 Alaska Administrative Code 75.280. Going to 75.280, I think there's a lot more information about an oil terminal facility and the classification, but it says if a vessel is to operate as an oil terminal facility, as defined in AS 4604-900, etc. So, what is the issue? The Alaska statutes are very clear that they require land-based oil terminals and vessels that deliver oil as cargo to have oil spill response plans known as contingency plans. House bill, this particular bill does not touch any of those contingency plans, oil spill response requirements, anything of that nature. That's not what this bill seeks to do. Land-based terminals have a planning standard that requires equipment to respond to a spill from their largest tank. Vessel operators, however, have a planning standard that requires equipment to respond to spill from a percentage of their total cargo. The planning standards differ for each entity because responding to oil spills on water is quite different from responding to those same spill on land. Commingling and lack of clarity regarding the definition of oil terminal facility is the chief cause of the concern that fuel delivery vessel operators in Alaska, stakeholders, have brought to the chair and to the committee, which is the reason for this bill. It appears that the definition of oil terminal facility that includes vessels that transfer fuel to smaller vessels in state waters now requires vessels that already have oil spill contingency plans to now plan for and acquire what could be tens of millions of dollars of new equipment to comply with oil terminal facilities planning requirements. The additional requirements and the financial commitments to meet them are a concern to these stakeholders because those requirements will cost time and money, which will be passed then on to customers. Also, there is delay. That's the time piece. We are approaching April. There is constant fuel delivery that occurs, and the more time that is taken, there's some question marks as to whether operations have to be paused or suspended until such time as they meet the oil terminal facility requirements. So that's the reason the bill was brought to the chair and to the committee. The sectional analysis then says this, Section 1 of HB 128, amends AS 4604-900 subsection 14 to specify that a vessel with a discharge prevention and contingency plan approved under AS 4604-030 is not considered an oil terminal facility. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as the chair mentioned today, there are four people here who are able to answer your questions. And Mr. Chairman, we have been asked if Mr. Kevin O'Shea from Vitus Marine could first give a short invited testimony, followed by Mr. Jim Butler with Baldwin and Butler, who can perhaps speak a little, well, not even perhaps, who could definitely speak more intelligently on the subject, and then however you want to proceed with Q&A.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Witt. I appreciate it, and thanks for all your hard work on this bill. So let us talk with Mr. O'Shea, unless there's any questions from the committee. Let's hear from Mr. Kevin O'Shea. He's the Safety and Environmental Manager of Vitus Engineering, the LLC, and he's with us on Teams. Mr. O'Shea, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. I'd like to thank the speaker for the opportunity to present to the group here. I am also the president of the Alaska Fuel Storage and Handlers Alliance, which is a industry group of approximately 20 members that is made up of fish processors, tug and barge companies, power generating companies, spill co-ops throughout the state of Alaska that handle refined petroleum products. There are approximately 200 million gallons of fuel that come into the state by marine. About half of that, or 100 million gallons, would be impacted due to the definition. And the primary focus on that is the barge-to-barge transfer, where we load it from a tanker offshore and bring a larger barge into delivery areas to make the final miles and transfer to the smaller barges into the villages. And those transfers do occur in state waters. And the concern is that now that we know of the statute and currently are not in compliance with the statute, is that insurance coverage would be null and void if there were an issue. It's difficult in the marine industry to get insurance for specific areas, specifically Alaska. There are international groups that provide this coverage. And if we are not in compliance with regulatory and statute, there is question as to whether we would have any coverage in the event of an incident. The operators are not seeking to lessen what we are doing presently. We just want to clear up the definition to prevent question.
Okay, Mr. O'Shea, I appreciate the discussion. Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. O'Shea? Okay, then next we'll go to Mr. Jim Butler. He's the principal at Incident Response Group, and he's joining us via Teams as well. Mr. Butler, please put your name on record and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Butler. I'm in Kenai, Alaska today, enjoying some wet snow, some Juneau weather, I guess. And I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee. Just briefly, by way of background, I've been involved in kind of oil spill specific, not only compliance issues, but actual responses for, I like to tell people, since the last decade. It's been quite a while. What I'd like to do is just real 30, 50,000 foot view, is just bring to the committee's attention the basic structure, which we've heard a little bit about, at kind of the impact of the change from an interpretation of regulations versus statutes. The definition of vessel in the statute at 4604-900 is somewhat like a nesting doll. The term vessel actually then has three components to it. The vessel definition includes non-tank vessels, which are vessels that are defined in state laws being greater than 400 tons. It's a unit of measurement for a ship. Oil barges and tank vessels. So that's sort of where we start. When we get into the definition of question, then we get to oil terminals, these oil terminal facility definition, but it brings in that term vessel, and it exempts non-tank vessels, but because it keeps the vessels in, the definition applies to both oil barges and these tank vessels. And as Kevin pointed out, quite a few, over half of the fuel product delivered into Western Alaska is involved in ship-to-ship transfers. We also heard them talk a little bit about the difference in the cargo planning standard. But I'd like to maybe give the committee an example if that would help. If I have a 100,000-barrel barge that I load full of cargo and take from Nikiski to Dutch Harbor to deliver, let's say, 50% of my load, my planning standard is 15% of the capacity of my vessel. If I then take that barge and go from Dutch Harbor to sit off of Nome in state waters and distribute to smaller barges that can deliver to rural communities up the rivers, my planning standard is now 100%. And that's of the total capacity of the barge, not the amount of cargo on board. So even if I'm at 50% of my capacity, my planning standard is still for 100%. Now, it's important to understand that over time, as barges have been regulated, the oil spill response system has been set up and has been able to comply with the DEC regulations for oil spill response plans. And the issue that we have before us today is that because of this definition, simply changing something in the regulations, as we know, doesn't necessarily change the legislature's component, which is the statute. So the proposal is to make clear that if a vessel is doing ship-to-ship transportation or transport of oil, it might still be considered an oil terminal facility. However, if it already has a state plan and meets the equipment and financial response requirements, it can continue to do so. The other element of this that I think is worth bearing out is the investment that industry has made in the equipment that's now doing these types of operations in Western Alaska. Because of changes in the availability of fuel from the West Coast or from Asia, they have invested tens of millions of dollars into new equipment that is specifically designed to do ship-to-ship transfers of product, like what we're talking about, in very safe, measured, and sort of mechanically sophisticated ways. So really, from a risk standpoint, it's almost safer to be at anchor moving fuel between vessels, such as the ship-to-ship transfer anticipates, than it is to get underway from Nikiski all the way for multiple days out to Dutch Harbor. So what we'd like to see the committee consider is to just simply recognize that this nesting doll term facility or vessel could stay in place. However, if you have a vessel that already has an oil spill contingency plan, it follows that plan. And a operator of a vessel does not have to go and look in oil terminal regulations to make sure that their vessel is still in compliance. We'd like to keep those silos distinct and clear because of the nature of their operations. With that, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd stand ready for any questions. I would like to be sensitive to your busy schedule and be available if I could be help clarify any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Butler. I appreciate that. I'd like to let the record reflect that Representative Stutz joined us at 1:13. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Tiffany Larson is the director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response, and she's on Teams, and I'm wondering if Ms. Larson had any comments that she'd like to make before we before we move forward?
Yeah, for the record, Tiffany Larson, Division Director, spoke French and in response at DEC. So to provide some additional clarity, I think the timing of the bill before this body isn't lost on me. And mentioning the Exxon Valdez may seem a bit kind of grandstanding. That's 34 years and 6 days ago, March 24th, 1989. And why do I tell you that? Because that's what we do here at SPAR, is we prepare for, plan for, and prevent oil spill releases. That's the mission. And I think we all agree we don't want spills of any magnitude in our waters or to reach our shores. And Exxon, for context, was carrying 53 million gallons and released close to 11 million gallons into Prince William Sound. The tank vessels and oil barges that we're talking about that we have on record in Alaska carry between 9,000 and 54.6 million gallons. And so that's just context for you to understand the size of the vessels we're talking about here today. In the early 80s, the legislature considered vessels on state waters to be these oil terminal facilities when conducting high-risk ship-to-ship transfers and traveling between land facilities and ship-to-ship transfer locations. And historically, the department has interpreted that to mean that they can use the contingency plan coverage they hold for their land-based facility while only meeting the financial responsibility requirements based on the vessel and barge size. And that's 70% that of land-based facility. And I think it's also worth mentioning, so historically, DEC hasn't interpreted this statute to mean or have all the implications that some of the other presenters were concerned about today. And then additionally, I think I want to bring up another point that DEC as the regulator has not issued any letters of noncompliance or notices of violation to these vessels for failure to carry double contingency plan coverage or double financial responsibility based, as I just said, on our historical interpretation of the regulations and statutes. So currently, the bill before you, AS 4604-900-14, provides for a narrow definition of when vessels are considered an oil terminal facility. And that's only when they're conducting high-risk operations. And, of course, we know why we want coverage for high-risk operations. The current language limits that application to the definition of vessels because that first clause includes offshore facilities. The choice to modify the definition section in statute versus the specific statute is fraught with challenges. You heard earlier the term nesting doll, and I think that is the most appropriate way to talk about this. Changing a definition section has some of the most trickle-down effects you can imagine when you talk about statutes and regulations. And so, in seeking a change to definitions, we're looking at, to give you an idea, we need to identify all of the industry that could be impacted, all of the operations that could be impacted, all of the regulations, and all of the statutes that could be impacted by this definition change. And for us right now, and you'll see in your packet, that's Alaska Statute 4604, 18AAC 75, Articles 1, 2, and 4. Are impacted here. So when we talk about nesting doll and the implications of changing the definition section, those are vast, and we shouldn't kind of take it on lightly. So has the department been consistent in our interpretation over the years that we don't require double coverage? Yes. Does this require a statutory change to address? No, because we've been consistent. And can we provide more clarity in the regulations? Of course. We provided two letters in support saying, I appreciate your interpretation, but this isn't how the department's using it, and we're not enforcing it that way. And those should also be in the packet. So I think, contrary to the intent of the bill, the result of House Bill 128 arguably would be that vessels with approved contingency plans are no longer only considered oil terminal facilities when conducting high-risk operations, but instead would now always be considered oil terminal facilities for the mere fact that they're an offshore facility. This could increase the regulation of vessels and conflict with the department's longstanding interpretation of contingency plan and FR requirements applied to those vessels. So I think the question to ask yourselves is, we, DEC, needs you to tell us whether you want vessels to have contingencies in place and ultimately a lesser liability than oil terminal facilities. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. So first I'll look to the committee to see if you have any questions. So Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I understand this, the regulations are counter to the statute. The statute says one thing, but you've interpreted them and written regulations around something that is not statutory. So I don't think if we want to accomplish this, we have a choice because the statute trumps the regulation in every case. And so I don't think we have a choice but to change the statute because we have nothing to do with the regulations. The department's been, I guess by, I don't say admission, been overlooking the statute for I don't know how many years, which I'd be interested to know how many years the statute's been being, has been being ignored. So my question is, what's the issue? We have to change. If we're going to change this, it has to be through statute. It can't be regulation. The statute's clear. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So was that a question?
The question to Tiffany, yes.
Ms. Larson, did you hear the question?
Yeah, for the record, Tiffany Larson, Director, Spill Prevention Response. It's hard to tell who's speaking with this camera angle, so
Craig Johnson,
representative through the chair. I think we have not been misapplying the statutes. What we have been is saying we understand the statutes to mean this, and as such, we're already doing what this statute seeks to do by adding it in the definitions. We're already doing that because we think it already read that way. So we've been behaving that way since the 1980s when the legislature first proposed this. So I don't know that it is a misinterpretation. I would say it's more correct to say, or misread. We've been interpreting it exactly how this bill seeks to do.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. So maybe I could help with this. Mr. Butler, I think this question is for you. If the statute and the regulations conflict and there is a spill that should be covered by insurance, do you think that the insurance company would use the conflict between statute and regulation or use the statute to get out of paying an insurance claim?
Sounds like that's Chairman McCabe.
It is.
Jim Butler for the record. At the risk of demonstrating my cynicism toward the international insurance companies, I would say, it's more likely than not that they'll look for a reason not to pay a claim than to pay a claim. It's just the nature of the business. They don't make money when they pay claims. I would say this, however, it does, in addition to the insurance, it adds a lot of complexity to the fact that the system has been built around an amount of equipment based on how DEC has been interpreting, if you will, their regulations. And our concern is all we need is a change of guard at DEC, and that all could change again. And we might have a different view of things. And I think what the industry is looking at is, with the tens of millions of dollars of investment they make in oil spill response resources, is to know that they're making that investment and it's not subject to a change in regulatory interpretation, but that they know that they're following the law. And that's what they're hoping to accomplish.
Thank you. Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you can see, I've got a puzzled look on my face. So it seems to me that the question is, DEC is interpreting the regs or the statute in one capacity, and the insurance companies are more than likely interpreting it in another way, which would preclude possibly an individual or a carrier or a business being covered if there were an accident.
So Representative Stutz, and for the record, it's Representative McCabe, Chairperson McCabe. So, yes, when this was brought to me, the DEC is interpreting the statute via their regulations, and the barge owners are complying with that interpretation. So everybody's on the same page except the insurance companies. And now they are looking at this saying, well, wait a minute. We can't provide you coverage because you're not doing exactly what this says. So, and the problem is we have letters, and we had, the DEC has said, well, if you do it the way we say in regulation, and this is sort of my understanding as well, if you do it, then you're okay, and we're not going to fine you and all that kind of stuff. And those letters are great, but in my opinion, and just Kevin's opinion, but the insurance companies will say, sure, fine, we'll write you a policy. But then, based on my experience, if something happens, insurance companies can use that to wiggle out, if you will, because that's what they do, of paying a claim. And then who's on the hook for the cleanup? We are. The state is.
So if I might follow up
sure.
with that information, my first question is, has DEC reached out to any of these insurers to have any kind of conversation with them to alleviate this? And if not, it can't be a surprise that anybody would want to make sure that they're properly covered. I mean, this is huge. I'm just surprised at the pushback from DEC.
So, yeah, Representative Stutz, Representative McCabe here again. We are planning a conference with all of the stakeholders in this on Monday, I believe. And so our intent right now is to get this bill out there, get it heard, get you thinking about it. I'm going to set it aside today. We're going to have a conference on Monday with the attorneys and DEC and myself, and we're going to come to some sort of agreement that – or not agreement, but some sort of possibilities that we can present to you. If not next week, then the week after. Representative Sumner.
Right. Through the chair, I would not expect DEC to, on the record, say that the way they've been interpreting the statute for the last 20 years is incorrect. I mean, so just to be clear there, I would expect them to do exactly what they are doing right now and defend their regulations. But that doesn't mean that we should not do this. So.
If I follow up, and I don't necessarily disagree with you, but it seems to me that DEC, knowing the issue, could certainly reach out to try and resolve this issue if they're so opposed to changing the statute based on their interpretation.
And to their credit, the DEC has given us some possible amendments that we're discussing, and those will be part of the possibilities we'll bring back. We want to find some way for this to make sense for the owners, for the DEC, and to make sure that we as a state are covered under the insurance that the barge owners and the vessel owners who have difficult time getting insurance anyways are applying for. It would be a shame for them to spend millions of dollars a year or however much they spend on insurance and then have an incident or a spill. And all of a sudden, somebody's on the hook for the cleanup, and who's it going to be? I was over top of the Exxon Valdez spill within hours of it happening during the just before the start of herring season. But you're aware of how bad it affected fishermen, and it was heartbreaking. Heartbreaking. So I think it's incumbent on us to find a path forward through this, however it works. And I think the DEC agrees. And they've proposed some amendments, so we're going to hash those out amongst the stakeholders and bring it back to you probably week after next or next week if there's time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to hear of the negotiations going on. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In addition to that, I am wondering if an insurance company would even issue a policy under these kind of not knowing how much it could be and who's going to be responsible? Is it the state? They might be willing to issue a big policy if we're on the hook. So they'd probably be more than happy to accept that because of the deep pockets. So I'm curious if they'll even start looking at it with the ambiguities in the policy. They're just not worth their time.
Right. And so Representative Johnson, it's Representative McCabe again. That's what generated this,
okay,
is the insurance company replying to some of the barge owners. And, you know, we're coming up on barge season pretty quick. We have a whole bunch of villages in western Alaska and on the rivers that are going to need, you know, what did he say, 200 million gallons? That's a big chunk. And I can't imagine what we would have to do if we couldn't get fuel to the villages this summer. So, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see you have someone on from the Department of Law, and I'd like to have their insight into the situation that we're in, and if they have any idea on how we can resolve this and the impacts of this legislation as written.
Okay, Mr. Is it Jimmo?
Yes, it is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Cameron Jimmo, Alaska Department of Law. Representative through the chair, Department of Law has reviewed HB 128 and kind of the related materials explaining kind of what the bill is purporting to do. The Department of Environmental Conservation's position conforms with the Department of Law's reading of AS 4604 in that the issues to be resolved here do not exist in AS 4604 as currently written. There is, as the Department of Law interprets the statute, there is distinctions between the applicable response planning standards when it comes to tank vessels and oil barges versus oil terminal facilities. Despite the definition at 4604.914 as currently written. And I guess the second point the Department of Law would like to raise also aligns with a point raised earlier by the Department of Environmental Conservation in that if these issues did exist, that they would be better addressed in the specific statutory sections regarding response planning standards or, you know, the other requirements that are of concern here, versus making a change to a provision defining oil terminal facility due to the potential kind of unforeseen, unintended consequences a definition change could bring.
Thank you, Mr. Jimmo.
Follow-up. Mr. Jimmo, as I read this, the change on line 8 and 9 says a vessel, comma, other than a non-tank vessel or a vessel with an oil discharge prevention and contingency plan is considered an oil terminal facility only when it's used to make ship-to-ship transfer of oil. So is my interpretation that correct if I were to say all vessels with a contingency plan would then be considered an oil terminal facility if they make ship-to-ship transfer?
Representative through the chair, so the Department of Law's interpretation of what, I guess the result of what HB 128 would achieve here by including this additional language, and I'll refer to a point that Ms. Larson raised during her comments. If you look at the first clause of the definition, which, you know, oil terminal facility means an onshore or offshore facility, that language, particularly the phrase offshore facility, has been interpreted by the Department of Law historically to include vessels to begin with. So taking that into context, the second clause here that begins with a vessel is seen as narrowing the application of this definition to vessels to these operations that are expressed in the definition. So, arguably, the inclusion of this language can be interpreted to, instead of removing these vessels from the definition of oil terminal facility is removing these vessels from the narrow application of when this definition applies, instead reverting it to the first clause, which is another reason why the Department of Law thinks that changes outside of the definition to the specific statutory sections would be a more narrow, tailored approach that can more accurately convey what's trying to be achieved here.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is to Jim in the Department of Law, and I can't read the last name. I apologize. Is it possible to define vessel differently in different portions of the statute where we could narrow this down and define a transfer or a vessel narrowly in this legislation and not have to go through all the rigors of changing it everywhere till we avoid that trickle-down effect? Is that something we could do in drafting or in through statute or law? Is that something we could even look at?
And I think that's for Mr. Jimmo, not Jim okay. Butler.
I'm sorry, yes. Department of Thank Law.
Representative through the chair, the Department of Law, can't say for sure whether that specific approach would work here, but the idea of a more tailored approach like that seems favorable in this instance. Even if, it weren't kind of amending the definition of vessel in certain instances, but instead saying, for instance, a vessel with an applicable seaplan or vessel seaplan meets the requirements that an oil terminal facility must meet, or, for instance, saying that a vessel with a vessel seaplan only needs to meet the response planning standards for vessels. Something along those lines could potentially be an alternative here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Jimmo. And just for the committee's knowledge, one of the stakeholders that we are including in our meeting on Monday is going to be Ledge Legal, a statute writer. And so with all the lawyers and legal minds in the room, please pray for me.
we're in real trouble.
So I think I'll turn this over to Mr. Witt for a wrap-up, and then I have public testimony scheduled, but I don't see anybody online for public testimony, so we'll open and close that pretty quickly and offer it again as well. So, Mr. Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Buddy Witt, staff to Representative McCabe. Two items I wanted to add for the committee's edification is that DEC has been very engaging on this issue, and I don't want to give the impression that they haven't. And I think everyone involved in this issue has been very communicative. They want to find a resolution. It's just a matter of getting there. And to your point, Mr. Chairman, Legislative Legal is developing, or we have requested, and they are efforting a comparison of the language in this bill compared to DEC's suggested language, working through some of that, and that will be part of the discussion. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear for the record. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So with that, I think I'll open public testimony. And seeing as, unless there's somebody in the room that would like to testify. Okay, so I see no one online. Public testimony is closed. We went through that theater. Any additional questions or comments from committee members? Okay, seeing none, thank you to those who appeared before the committee today. We'll set this bill aside and bring it back before committee at a future date. The next committee meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, April 4th, and seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect that the time is 1:44 p.m. Thank you, everybody.